Welcome to Minute 28 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast, where we take a wild trip through the 1987 John Hughes comedy, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Jim O'Kane.
Great.
Who's been on so many different Movies by Minute podcasts, like The Rocketeer, the Apollo 13 Minute, and a whole bunch of different collaborative projects, including the current one that's running consecutively with us, the Silverado Minute. So welcome back, Jim.
Thanks for having me. It's here we are at Hump Day already. And it's funny. Yesterday we were talking about minutes that don't have much going on and trying to find things to talk about. So here we are at that very opportunity with very little dialogue, but quite a bit of action.
There is no dialogue in this. There's mumbling. That's the only bit of dialogue that we have throughout this entire minute. Is one of the characters mumbling for, 2 seconds?
Yes.
And that's where we go.
And the pigs at the end of the minute don't get a screen credit, so I guess they don't have any words.
They do not. So episode 28 begins with Neil realizing that he's going to stay in this motel in the end, and he starts returning his belongings to the shelf. And goes all the way till, as you just mentioned, by spoiling it for everyone, pigs squealing.
Wow. And
so basically, yesterday we finished this argument between Del and Neil. Both of them pretty much have said all they have to say at this point and are ready to basically move on. You know, just deal with what they've been dealt.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about it in more detail yesterday about the fact of how each of them really got their personalities. They show their personalities to the audience through these past few minutes, through this deep argument. And we actually get to see an even deeper part of their personalities by seeing the way that they both finally just have, I wouldn't say give up, but the two of them have said, okay, we've done enough. Let's just move on from here. This is, I guess, something they had to get out of their system.
Yeah, it didn't clear the air, but it just blew off steam, I guess. They're just trying to find a modus vivendi, and it's not there. But in this non dialogue minute, I think where I usually go is I start looking at other things when I find a no dialogue minute.
Well, because there's so much going on here.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's little moments of 80s-ness and earlier things. The thing that I noticed the most in this movie of being part of the 80s are the coat hangers.
Yes.
You know, it is a low rent, low budget. One star hotel on a highway.
You'd call it a one-star hotel?
Maybe.
I don't even know if we would go that far.
If they let you do a half star, maybe, you know, just it does have indoor plumbing, barely. I noticed the dollar store plastic coat hangers, which any hotel, even like a half a step up from that, would have the wooden ones that have the hooks that fit into the other hooks that are permanently mounted on the coat hanger.
Right. Can't steal, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And these are instead of doing it that way, these are coat hangers that nobody would want to steal.
Yeah, exactly. It's cheaper to go and buy them than to have to deal with stealing them.
Yeah, I have to say that the set decorators did their job very well. Everything there, there's so much awful.
Well, it is a real motel, so the question is whether it really, you know, whether they use the real stuff in the room or not.
Yeah, I would guess. I mean, like the exterior would be real, but I'm just wondering if this to me looked like it was built as a set. And they took some of the accoutrements of that hotel. Not that they're hard to find, but it just seems like, oh gosh, the giant feathers that are sticking out of the vase by Steve Martin's side of the bed, and the horrible artwork, and those push button lamps that are mounted on sconces on the wall. Anybody's ever stayed in a hotel that knows how hard that is on your thumbs to turn it off, because those switches are just, they're not built to twist or push. The thing that I love the most about this, we've all stayed in bad hotels, and boy, this really, you can smell it. You can feel the stickiness as you're in the, You don't take your socks off when you're, you know, walking on the floor.
Right, which is interesting, the fact that Dell still makes himself very comfortable in a place like this. Because your normal person would be somewhat grossed out by a lot of things that go on in these type of motels. And Dell is not. Dell, you know, this is where he usually is. Now, I mean, it's something that I haven't mentioned up until now. You know, you see that they're both using the same bedspread or blanket. You'd think that they would have called up the front desk and at least asked for another one.
Yeah, I just,
It's not like
you
you're
know,
going to
it's.
get one that's going to be dirtier than the one that you have on the bed.
And you know, if I mean, my personal experience with being in a hotel like this is the last thing you want to do is put that bedspread on, because the sheets might get washed, but that bedspread never gets washed.
That's
So
true
it's like
also.
you just peel it off with tongs and then just go, you know, suffer through with just using the sheets.
Yeah,
But yeah,
but
it's
you got to give them credit. It is the end of November, so it could be that it's
it
very
is.
cold, and who knows if the heat really works well there. So they might need that.
It's
Even though Neil
yeah, you
isn't
do.
dressed for the winter, Dell is, but Neil is
No,
not.
I just you can feel the crunchiness of the carpet in that hotel. I can remember I stayed at a Days Inn in Philadelphia once, and it was the only place that was available, and I just remember that the rug made noise when you walked on it. It was just and it didn't squeak, it kind of like smushed,
Ooh.
and the bathtub didn't drain. I mean, I turned on the shower to take a shower in the morning, and I just started hearing this deeper sound, and I looked in the shower, and it, you know, the drain was open, but nothing was going down.
Oh,
Okay, well, I
well.
guess I'll just head out and find a shower later. It was so it's a very tactile movie, but
Yes.
this minute I could just imagine snuggled up next to John Candy in a really bad hotel room. It just must be very, you could feel it down the, you know, down the base of your spine.
Yeah,
Just
completely.
another thing.
No question about that. So the two of them basically, Neil decides to get back in bed and just go to sleep. And we see once again the two of them trying to get comfortable in the bed, right? And then the scene switches, and we get a shot from outside. We see the door tour to the motel room, and we see a shady figure standing there. And then he pulls out a switchblade, and you see that he picks the lock with the switchblade. Now, what do you know about switchblades?
I know that they can't pick locks because the tumbler's inside that particular kind of lock. I mean, it's not a Schlage lock, but it's a that I know that that type of lock has at least four tumblers on it, and I don't see how you're going to get what's basically a, you know, an oversized butter knife into the slots to move it. But you know, this is a movie, so
Maybe it's
that's
broken.
how you do it.
If it's
Yeah, it
broken,
could. It,
actually, if it's broken, then you don't even need the switchblade. You can just turn the knob.
It might just be there's a pin or something, a single pin that he has to push in, similar to what they use in like bathroom doors and stuff. You just need something pointy enough.
Could be.
I don't know much about switchblades, but it's a very pretty
Yes,
switchblade.
that
I
is
have to
true.
say that.
That
It's
is
a
true.
very
Do
nice
you know
knife.
any other names for switchblades?
No, but I'll
Okay,
bet you
so
do.
it's sometimes, of course I do. I now do. I didn't know before I did research, but I now know. So it's sometimes called an automatic knife, a push button knife, an ejector knife, a spring knife, a flick knife, or a flick blade. So the obvious idea of a switchblade is that you push a button and it pops out. And the you basically just have you only have the handle, and when you push a button, so the blade pops out. So there are three different ways that they made these. Okay, you have the ones that come from the side opening, which we probably all remember from like movies from the 50s and stuff like that, where I'm pretty sure, exactly. No one
Oh
can see
yeah, I'm
what you
sorry.
just
No,
did,
but
Jim.
it was, you know, it's like if the only
It's a West Side Story move, you know. You just.
followed by a musical number and everybody snapping their fingers. So
Exactly. Exactly. So you have them that they come out of the side. Okay, now these are considered the most durable of switchblades. They're also usually much cheaper. The problem is that you can't grip the handle as firmly when you're activating the knife because you have to make sure that your hand is not in the way of where it's going to pop out, right? And another con of having this type of switchblade is that they're more limited in the type of shapes that the blade can be because the blade has to fit in to the side
Right.
of the hallway. Okay, then you have another type of switchblade, which is known as an OTF knife. It's out the front. Okay, so what those basically are, there are two different types. You have the double action OTF knives and the single action OTF knives. Okay, the double action ones are the ones where when you push the button, it pops out and you can retract the blade also by pushing the button again. Okay, so the
So it's kind of
problem.
a release that would also, and then there's must be a spring at the bottom so that when you press it in, it charges it for the next release. Okay.
Correct. So the advantage of these type is that it automatically retracts the blade, and it has a what's known as an at-rest position for the spring. Okay. The problem is that the mechanisms are much more complicated, and therefore they're much more expensive to buy these type of knives, but they also have a weaker firing action because of the fact that they need to go both ways. They need to go
Right.
out and back in.
So
And
they're
then,
probably prone to malfunctions too, I would
yes.
think, if, yeah.
Correct. And then you have the single action OTF knives, which basically you push the button and it pops out, but in order to put it back in, you have to do that manually to retract it. So they say that these are better because the blade is more firmly attached because it only has to pop out one way with the spring. And it also displays a lot less wobble and play than what you have in the double action because of the fact that it has the double springs.
I may be misremembering this, but if I recall correctly, somewhere in the late 60s, I think switchblades were made illegal that you wouldn't be able to sell them through the
We're going
mail.
to get into that right now.
Oh, okay.
So, how many states or US territories do you think today it is illegal to carry a switchblade? Of the
I'd
50,
go
what would you
with
say?
maybe 8.
Very close. There are seven.
Oh,
Okay.
okay.
Okay. Delaware, Hawaii, New Mexico, Puerto Rico, the US Virgin Islands, Virginia, and Washington. Those are the seven states and territories that it's illegal. Now, they have five other states which have it's known as limited. Okay. So I just found it really funny, so I'm going to quickly read off what these limited things are. So in Illinois, you're allowed to carry a switchblade if you have a valid firearm owner's identification card. In Minnesota, it's illegal unless it's allowed under exceptions made for collectors and/or possession as curios or antiques. So if you have a store that's selling antiques, you can have a switchblade. In
Oh, okay,
New
so.
Jersey and Pennsylvania, you're only allowed to possess it if you have it for lawful purpose. I'm not really sure what that really means. I don't know what a lawful purpose is.
You're not gonna rob a bank with this, are you? No. Okay, then you can
I
have
have it
it.
for lawful purpose. I wasn't able to figure out what a lawful purpose really is. And in New York, you can have it if you have a hunting, fishing, and trapping permit, then you're allowed to have a switchblade. So I thought that was pretty funny.
I was
So
just.
you mentioned about the fact that you weren't that you were curious as to when it became illegal to use it. So federally, it's a big problem. You're not allowed to send it across borders or take it across borders. In the 1950s, they had a lot of problems with it, and the tabloid press were continuing to the newspapers as well as tabloid press were promoting the image of violent crimes being caused by young male delinquents with switchblades. Okay.
Yeah, I blame Leonard
Yes.
Bernstein. That's
And in 1954, Democratic Representative James Delaney of New York actually authored the first bill submitted to Congress banning the manufacture and sale of switchblades, which began a wave of legal restrictions worldwide and a consequent decline in their popularity. Obviously, once it's illegal, nobody's going to have to deal with it anymore.
I was wondering if that if it's declared as arms. I'm just wondering if anybody ever posted any kind of a Second Amendment, counter to it.
I don't know about that. I mean, one of the things that I researched here, and we're not going to go into it, is I also have listed every single state, whether you're allowed to carry a switchblade or not. What I mentioned earlier about the illegal or legal aspects of it was possession. So there's the whole idea of possession carrying one. But we're not going to go into that. That would be too much to start talking about it.
Yeah, I was just looking up what I live in Texas, and I was, what's the Texas knife law? And as of September 1st, 2013, it is legal to manufacture, sell, repair, transport, and possess switchblades.
But only if it's less than 5.5 inches.
Okay. But you're still restricted to bring in areas like courthouses, police stations, schools, or government facilities. Yes. So, it's good. It's good to know I can go out and get a switchblade. I just don't know where I'd get one. So I'm just going to stick with my X-Acto knives because that seems to work best when I'm doing stuff around the house. I can't imagine a switchblade.
As long as it's for lawful purposes. And,
yeah, exactly. So, all right. I feel it's this. I think we've covered the switchblade. It's very adequately now. But yeah, I would guess not on the skill of the switchblade user here in this picture, but more on the deficit of that hotel room key, which and now he'd be defeated by all those near field cards that are in hotels nowadays, because nobody the old key that used to be able to drop in any mailbox to send it back to the hotel, those days are gone.
Exactly. So basically, this thief breaks into the room with his switchblade, and then we see him crouching next to Dell. You see a guy in a hat. Now, the actor who plays this is Gary Riley. Do you recognize him from anything? Have you seen him in anything?
No.
Okay, so
I may have, but I don't know by the name.
He was in a number of movies in the 1980s. He was in Stand By Me. He played Charlie Hogan.
Oh, okay.
He was in Ruthless People. He was actually in Back to the Future playing one of Biff's henchmen. And he's mostly known for his role in Summer School, where he played Dave. You had two of the which is a Carl Reiner film, as you mentioned earlier this week. So we had these two characters, Dave and Chainsaw, who were these horror movie freaks who constantly talk about horror movies and they want to make a horror movie and things like that. So he's one of those characters.
Okay. That is a fascinating hat that he's wearing. It has like a zebra striping to it, and I don't know if that's a brand or
No clue. I wasn't able to find that one out. So this actor was actually rumored to have died in a car accident in 2007, in a car accident in New York, and apparently there was another actor with the exact same name who died, and that's why people had the misconception that he actually was this actor who died. And he ended up posting on Facebook a picture where he basically said, "I'm still alive."
Oh, he had to hold up like today's newspaper and say, "Proof of life."
Exactly. Wow. That type of thing. Now, he was also in the running for one of the two top spots in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Wow.
And apparently he was one of the finalists and missed out on it. So when we talk about the script, we'll get more into him because his character is much more detailed in the script. So basically, he rifles through the wallet and pulls out a large wad of cash. Okay, and he has this like very wicked look on his face when he's taking out the money. And then what's interesting is he folds up the money and puts it in his hat. He doesn't put it in his pocket or anything like that. And the music is pretty good here. It's like this mysterious type of music.
Yeah.
Trying to think. And then we see Neil moving a little bit. And then he looks up, this thief looks up and sees Neil moving, and then he crouches down. So apparently, not to be seen or anything like that. But I believe that what he's doing there is he's actually going over to Neil's side to go steal his money.
Ah, okay. Yeah. But noticing when he's pulling out the bills, that is a lot of $1 bills. I don't know how much Dell had, but it didn't seem like it was very much.
Right. In the script, we talked about it last week. He had hundreds of dollars in his wallet, but maybe it was all in ones. I don't know.
Yeah. Was this in the original script, or was this added in later?
We'll talk about that in a few minutes when we get to the the end of the minute. I'll keep you in suspense for a few more minutes.
Yeah, and
okay. Then we basically, he leaves the room, and we see a shot from outside of the motel, and it's morning, and they show a long shot of the whole of the hotel from afar, which is pretty interesting. I mean, like, what would you think the significance is that they're showing us this with a whole bunch of pigs across the way?
If you've ever been anywhere near a pig farm, the smell is indescribable. It is just, it's like living next to paper mills and pig farms. Just to give an example, the town of Secaucus, New Jersey, used to supply bacon to the New York City area. And they had a large pig farm in the Jersey Meadowlands. The pigs, they stopped having the pig farms there in the late 1950s, early 1960s. To this day, you can still smell pig feces from 50 to 70 years after they got rid of the land.
Wow.
The smell is incredible. So just if you know anything about being around any of our porcine folks here, it's this is like, I think John Hughes knows.
Roll up your windows.
Yeah, definitely. It's hold your breath and wait for the next mile marker to show up, because it's pretty awful.
Right. I mean, I think that the reason that they're showing this is to show us that this motel is in one of the worst places possible.
Yeah.
It's right across the street from a pig farm.
Yeah,
that's what it comes down to.
And you see all the, like, in the background of, even though this is only a couple of second shot, in the background of this motel, there's a bunch of 18-wheelers. It's a large truck parking lot behind there, all the different rider trucks and things. So you're going to be awakened in the morning by the smell of pigs and the sounds of diesel engines starting up to get on their day's work, which is probably like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. It's just...
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
So basically this whole scene supposedly takes place in Kansas. So I did a little bit of research, and there are currently 1,000 hog farms in Kansas. Okay. And 150 of them produce over 99% of the state's pigs.
Wow.
Meaning that most of those hog farms have very few pigs on them.
Yeah, that's
okay.
You don't need many, I can tell you that. It's pretty bad.
All right. Well, Kansas is the number 10 state in hog and pig inventory, producing about 2.7% of the nation's total. In 2019, Kansas producers sold 3.7 million market hogs, feeder pigs, and seed stock, with a gross market value of nearly $500 million.
Wow.
Okay. These hogs produced over 600 million pounds of pork, which helped feed millions of people in the U.S. and abroad. Okay.
Wow.
So
that's a lot of sausage. Yeah.
Yes, that is definitely true. I personally don't know, because I don't eat pork, but apparently.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's many other ways. If you eat corn, you're contributing to the Kansas economy one way or the other.
Right, that's true.
That is definitely true. These pigs seem to be in an already harvested corn meadow, so they must be really going to town on the gleanings there. I'm interested. I wonder about the pig wranglers that had to line up the pigs and get them into the shot to get. This particular one, it must have been quite a morning getting this all set up.
Yeah, probably. So I just have a little more information about what they would feed the pigs. So they consume over 30 million bushels of grain.
Wow.
And at the prices of January 2019, the pork industry spends over $90 million just on grain and corn for these pigs. Okay. And... Wow. The pigs also consume over 8 million bushels of soybeans a year. And according to 2019 prices, the pork industry spends over $64 million just on the soybeans that they're feeding these pigs.
Wow.
So that's a hell of a lot of money.
And plus, I mean, just the amount of money you have to spend on soap after you're done working with the pigs all day. I don't know how you get this. I don't know how you get the smell out. The smell is just unbelievable. I've never, I've lived in farm country in Virginia, and that's where Smithfield hams and things come from. There's a lot of pigs in Virginia, and chicken coops smell pretty bad. If you've been around chickens, they're pretty nasty smelling. But if you could just crank that up about 10 times, that's what a pig farm smells like.
Wow.
So it's just, but yeah,
yeah, no thanks.
But yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting that they dropped this in on a 5 second thing. So I guess, you know, people who have been around the farms know what that smells like. And if you don't, you can imagine how bad this
right.
is.
But, I think it's subliminal because most people aren't going to register it. I mean, when you're doing it minute by minute, you will see it. But otherwise, you're not really going
to
notice.
I'm just trying to imagine trying to eat at Eddie's. You know, there's a restaurant with cocktails, and just trying to eat lunch there or eat a breakfast while you're smelling this aroma coming from across the highway. But yeah, it just looks like not a place you want to see. What a place you want to get up early and get out of town.
Exactly.
Fast. So that
I mean, thankfully, most of my experiences in motels were when we were going on a family trip somewhere. So, you know, we get there late at night and we'd leave first thing in the morning, and that was it. We never stayed. Doesn't matter. We would change probably places similar to this, where it's in the middle of nowhere. You know, you're just somewhere on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, you know, or something like that. And just, all right, we're going to stop here and that's it. Nothing planned or anything like that.
I stayed once in Monroe, Louisiana. It was just driving late at night, and Monroe is in the northeastern part of Louisiana. And we pulled in and I smelled something not that great. I couldn't figure out what it was, but I thought, I'll find out in the morning. It's probably just something temporary. Got up in the morning and there was a paper mill next door to this hotel. We're saying you couldn't see it at night because it was just, it was dark and rainy. But when morning came up, it was hot and there was this haze, this yellow haze in the air. And the smell of fermenting wood pulp was horrific. Even thinking about it now, this was like 20 years ago, but thinking about it even now, my nose still just crunches up thinking about it. But paper mills, I couldn't imagine living in a town with a paper mill that smelled like that. But that's my reflection on this particular couple of seconds.
All right. So you have anything else for this minute?
No, I'm good for this.
All right. So we'll now talk about the few discrepancies in the script. So the first thing is that as soon as Neil and Del get into bed, they actually both apologize to one another. You know, Neil says sorry, and then Del waits for a long pause and says, so am I. And then they both wish each other good night and go to sleep. Del then starts talking about bed bugs and stuff like that, but we're not really going to go into that because he starts saying, sleep tight, don't let the bed bugs bite. And then starts talking about the fact, I've actually never seen a bed bug and things like that. So after they go to sleep, then we have a three line description of what happens with this intruder. Okay. So one of the things that was cut out of the final cut of the movie was the fact that they had ordered pizza and beer. Okay.
That explains the Miller can.
That is correct. So they had ordered it. And when the pizza boy came, and I mean, we discussed this a week and a half ago, but just to refresh everyone's memory, when the pizza boy showed up, so Neil was in the shower and Del couldn't find his wallet. So he basically took money out of Neil's wallet and paid for it from there. Then Del gets into an argument with the pizza boy about a tip. So the phrase in the script at this point says the pizza boy is still hanging around. He puts his ear to the door and listens. He reaches into his back pocket and withdraws a room key. And that's all it says. Okay. And obviously, you know, the script leaves it open, the fact that he actually goes into the room and steals their money. But it basically all has to do in the script with the fact that he got into an argument with Del over the tip. So he basically decided, I'm going to come and take my own tip. But the thing that really gets me with this phrase is the fact that he actually has a room key. You know, he's not using a switchblade. I guess they decided in the final cut that they would change it and make it look like that he's breaking in instead of just using a key. You know, maybe he knows Gus, and maybe Gus was sleeping and he just walked in and took an extra key or something like that.
Or maybe, yeah, maybe it was part of housekeeping or something, that his other job was working at
Yeah.
the hotel or
So
something.
what I find very interesting is apparently when they filmed this, so Gary Reilly had a larger part in this and he was the pizza boy. And because of all the editing that they did, they actually changed his character from being a pizza boy to being a motel thief.
Wow.
So,
Huh.
and then
I wonder how Gary felt about
no
that.
clue. I tried getting in
Huh.
touch with him on Facebook, but he didn't respond. So hopefully one day he'll respond and I'll be able to chat with him a little bit, find out what he says about all this. Who knows? And then the last thing is they describe the motel in the morning. And it's basically it's one line and it says it's even uglier in the daylight, in the middle of nothing. That's all it says.
Well, mission accomplished. Yeah. They followed that part of the script to the
Completely,
letter.
completely. All right. So every Wednesday, we do a little segment known as Hugh's Hump Day. So Jim is going to give us his top five movies by John Hughes.
Okay. Well, it's John Hughes. As I said, I'm not the biggest fan of John Hughes, but I do admire his ability, his creative skills. And so let me give you a, we'll have a countdown from five. Number five was he wrote the original story that National Lampoon's Vacation was based on. It was called Vacation 58. I remember reading it in National Lampoon. He wrote in a style similar to there was an author back in around the turn of the century named Ring Lardner, and Ring Lardner wrote a similar story called The Young Immigrants, and it was about a trip in the 1920s or 30s to Niagara Falls with a family. That's where there's a frequent phrase that people will refer to called "Shut up," he explained. And Ring Lardner came up with that thing. So he kind of copied Ring Lardner into this idea of a bad vacation gone wrong. And he wrote similar to that. I mean, back in the early 70s, National Lampoon people like PJ O'Rourke and John Hughes wrote these great stories that were would eventually become things like Ghostbusters and Animal House and stuff. So I appreciate that. I even though it wasn't a John Hughes film, it was in the style of John Hughes because John wrote the screenplay for Home Alone, which Chris Columbus directed, and it has all the elements of a John Hughes film: Chicago area, upper middle class family. Interactions between parents and kids, young main characters. I thought that it wasn't a John Hughes film, but Chris Columbus really did get the style of a John Hughes movie down very much, and also that cartoon like, where it sometimes it's like the Roadrunner and the Coyote. This was more like a Tom and Jerry film, where the back and forth between the burglars and Macaulay Culkin. Number three, speaking of Chicago area films of John Hughes, I think the most Chicago-y film was number three, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Has all those elements, a lot of kids with free time on their hands and young actors doing slapstick comedy. There's always the foil, the principal, the parents, I think Ferris Bueller is probably the peak John Hughes film. Number two, Breakfast Club, which could almost work as a stage play. I was impressed by Hughes does a lot of dialogue. He doesn't really rely on action. Mostly it's set pieces. You have a camera that's not moving a lot. And he tells stories mostly through the character's dialogue, similar to what Kevin Smith does in a lot of his, although Kevin Smith usually does it with more comedic
And
aspects of
he
it.
uses a lot
But
more colorful metaphors.
yes, that's true. That's true. And he, and again, it's another Brat Pack film. You've got some really big stars in the film. You've got Emilio Estevez. I don't have to go through the cast list. And his typical foil, Paul Gleason, always the perfect foil. And then number one film, of course, with John Hughes. I don't think there's too much of arguments with people. It's 16 Candles, I think, is one of his best films. That he's ever done, using Molly Ringwald as the centerpiece. He did understand teenage problems. I mean, here Molly Ringwald's character gets forgotten on her 16th birthday while everything else is going on around them. It it's very centered on John Hughes's audience, which was teenagers and, you know, young 20 somethings who either are experiencing what John Hughes is displaying on film or have recently experienced and can relate to the characters that are on screen. Some of the stuff is ridiculous, of course, but that's, it's comedy, and it doesn't have to all make sense.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's where I'm at. I'd say 16 Candles was peak John Hughes.
Excellent. That's great. Thank you very much. So once again, we have our daily segment, Off the Beaten Track, where Jim will tell us another one of his interesting adventures or misadventures.
Well, this one's a little bit more recent. I think earlier in the week I told childhood ones, but here's one from a couple of years back. Speaking of the middle of the country, I live in Texas. My good friends, Hal Bryan and Chris Henry, who I've done several podcasts with, invited me up to, they both work for the Experimental Aircraft Association in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And at the time they had invited me up to Oshkosh to visit the EAA's headquarters, it was the 50th anniversary of Apollo 8, first time mankind ever went around the moon. And their guest speaker was going to be Frank Borman, who was a childhood hero of mine. He was Time's Man of the Year 1968. He's the first man to, you know, pilot a Saturn V, and no one had ever flown on a Saturn V before. And the previous mission of a Saturn V almost ended in disaster, as the ship almost, you know, blew itself apart. So he drove it to the moon, and this was the 50th anniversary of Apollo 8. And so I went up to see them. I have I drive an electric car. I've had it for years, a Tesla. And I got to meet Frank Borman. We recorded a couple of episodes of our podcast up with him. And then it was time to go to lunch. He was going to be giving a keynote speech at the 50th anniversary dinner. And so I said, "Colonel, have you ever been in an electric car before?" He said, "No, I haven't. I've been reading about them, but I never have." So I got Frank Borman was my co-pilot from the EAA's headquarters. We went to lunch at a little place around the corner, and he was looking at the inside of the car as I was driving. And he said, "Wow, this is the future." I'm like, "Frank, you've been to the moon. Okay, that's about as future as it gets. I'm just giving you a ride in the car." But, you know, I get my thing about this, that whole little episode. And he loved the car. He thought it was great. And
you didn't let him drive?
Asked if he wanted to. And he said, no, I'm fine. And anyway, he flies planes. He flies a lot faster than my Tesla could ever go. But he just a very nice guy. He's, you know, people, they say you shouldn't meet your heroes. But gosh, if you ever get a chance to meet Frank Borman, I'd say do it. He's hilarious. He's very, very witty, very, very dry humor. But, I'm, you know, the other side of it was that I can now say that I had Frank Borman as my co-pilot. I told my wife, I said, you know, this, she always sits she likes me driving. So she was sitting in the passenger seat. I said, "You know, we get a plaque or something that said Colonel Borman sat here." So we'll see. But anyway, that's my story for today about traveling.
I'm always amazed at your stories. Thank you very much, Jim. That was once again another fascinating story. So why don't you once again tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Okay. Well, as we speak, somewhere on another channel, but you know, probably where you found this podcast, we are running a group project for Movies by Minutes called the Silverado Minute, where we take apart the 1985 Lawrence Kasdan directed feature. And so if you like Westerns, even if you don't like Westerns, a lot of people who don't watch Westerns but came in to talk about it, we've got 26 teams of Movies by Minutes hosts ready to talk about Silverado. So we're in the middle there. So drop by, listen there. You can find it at anywhere you're listening to this podcast probably, and also at our main site, silveradominute.com.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is even simpler. All you do is a quick search for Movie Rob Minute, and you can find me on Twitter, find me on Facebook, or you can find my website. So until tomorrow, you're fine.
Yeah, basically you're fine.